WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, good grief, it's Charles Schulz. We talk with the creator of Charlie Brown, Lucy Linus, and Snoopy. Schulz is now in his fifth decade of drawing his popular Peanuts comic strip. It's My Party and Judy's Turn to Cry aren't exactly songs of sisterhood, but you could consider You Don't Own Me a true proto-feminist anthem. Coming up, we talk with singer Leslie Gore about those early hits from the 60s and her 90s cabaret act. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Prince of Tides, directed by the star of the film, Barbra Streisand. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Mikhail Gorbachev officially resigned as head of the Soviet Union today and handed over control of the country's 27,000 nuclear weapons to Russian President Boris Yeltsin. In his televised address, Gorbachev took credit for ending the climate of hostility between the superpowers.
We're now living in a new world. An end has been put to the Cold War and to the arms race, as well as to the mad militarization of the country, which has crippled our economy, public attitudes and morals. The threat of nuclear war has been removed. Once again, I would like to stress that during this transitional period, I did everything that needed to be done to ensure that there was reliable control of nuclear weapons.
Despite the fact that he's no longer held in high esteem in the economically devastated republics, Gorbachev predicted that his policies will ultimately bear fruit.
Of course, there were mistakes made that could have been avoided, and many of the things that we did could have been done better, but I am positive that sooner or later, someday, our common efforts will bear fruit and our nations will live in a prosperous democratic society.
Gorbachev was the eighth and final leader of the Soviet Union. President Bush is scheduled to give a nationally televised speech tonight on the changes in the former Soviet Union. NPR's Claudia Polly reports.
Today's resignation of the eighth and final leader of the Soviet Union prompted the president to cut short his Christmas holiday at Camp David and return to Washington. In the address scheduled for 9 p.m. Eastern Time tonight, Mr. Bush is expected to outline the nature of U.S. relations with the new Commonwealth of Independent States. Especially important is how the United States will deal with the largest and most powerful of the Commonwealth republics, Russia, and its president, Boris Yeltsin. The Bush administration has made it clear that it will support Russia as the successor to the Soviet Union on the UN Security Council. And Robert Strauss, the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, will immediately become envoy to the Russian Republic. Official U.S. recognition of Russia as an independent nation is expected soon, possibly during the president's speech tonight. I'm Claudia Polly in Washington.
China blamed the United States today for the failure of talks aimed at resolving a trade dispute over copyrights, patents, and trademarks. A Chinese foreign trade official accused U.S. negotiators of making excessive demands. The United States has accused China of pirating American inventions and intellectual property and has threatened to retaliate with tariffs of 100% on hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Chinese goods. China has said it will match any punitive actions, prompting fears that the dispute could lead to a trade war. The two sides have agreed to meet once more before the final U.S. deadline on January 16th. U.S. trade officials say that China will run up a $13 billion trade surplus with the U.S. this year. This is NPR. Leaders of the Arab states on the Persian Gulf have ended their first summit meeting since the end of the Gulf War with a pledge to build up their military forces. The six-member Gulf Cooperation Council said it intended to form a joint defensive force to prevent anything like the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait from happening again. Council members also accused Iraq of not complying with the United Nations Security Council resolutions that ended the Gulf War. They said no GCC state would have any dealings with Baghdad until the resolutions were complied with. Jerusalem Mayor Teddy Kollek led a protest today against a recent move by Jewish settlers into an East Jerusalem village. Linda Gradstein reports.
2 weeks ago, about 80 Israelis moved into 20 apartments in the village of Silwan in Arab East Jerusalem. The move came after an Israeli court ruled that the settlers' land deeds were legal. Two Arab families were evicted. Today, longtime Jerusalem Mayor Teddy Kollek led a demonstration against the government and the Jewish settlers. Kalik, who has worked hard to foster Arab-Jewish coexistence in his city, said the trend of Jews moving into Arab areas of the city could lead to violence. He also denounced the Israeli Housing Ministry, which the settlers say gave them most of the $750,000 they used to buy the buildings. The evicted Arab families claim the settlers' leases are illegal, and they have appealed to a higher Israeli court. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Japan added another objection today to the disputes over farm subsidies that are jeopardizing world trade reform. Japan's cabinet agreed to oppose any measure that would open up Japan's tightly protected rice market. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades is trying to get countries to open up their agricultural markets and to stop subsidizing and unfairly protecting their own farmers. President Bush has said that the main purpose of his upcoming Asian tour will be to open markets. Japan's foreign minister reportedly said that Japan has no plans to open up its rice market. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Do you ever get depressed around Christmas? If so, you're not alone.
I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel. I just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed.
Charlie Brown, you're the only person I know who can take a wonderful season like Christmas and turn it into a problem.
Maybe Lucy's right. Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest.
That's from A Charlie Brown Christmas, which has become a TV classic. Last year, we spoke with Charlie Brown's creator, Charles Schulz, from his studio in Santa Rosa, California. We thought Christmas Day was the perfect time to play it again. Schulz has been drawing the Peanuts comic strip for 41 years. He told me how often he draws Peanuts now.
Well, I draw as much now as I've ever drawn in my whole life, although I don't work quite as long, but mainly it's a matter of family, I guess. I have always made it a policy to work 5 days a week. I work Monday to Friday, just like real people. And I'm at the studio by 9, and I usually quit about 4 o'clock these days. My schedule used to be dictated by 5 growing children. But now, even so, it's just a pattern. And I discover that I work best if I stick to a regular pattern.
Do you put in things into Peanuts that you think and feel now, or do you feel that you rely on memory about how children react to things?
I don't think much about children, actually, and I don't regard this at all as being a strip for children. I think that drawing a comic strip for children would be a wonderful thing, but I think it would be extremely difficult. I don't know of anybody these days who is drawing a really good strip for children, and in the history of comics, which I suppose could be about 80 years, I can think of only 3 or 4 who are ever really drawn for children. So I just draw what I think is funny and what thoughts come to me and what things work out. And I suppose you could say I simply draw for myself.
Now, you get older while the characters you draw stay the same age. Do you think that they've changed as you've grown?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that the characters have changed. I think the entire strip, the whole outlook, is much more mild from what it used to be. I don't think the characters are quite as sarcastic as they used to be, because I probably myself am not quite as sarcastic as I used to be. I think as you grow older, you begin to see both sides of issues more clearly. And my approach is just different, that's all, as I've gotten older.
There's a Peanuts from, I forget the year, it's in the 1950s, where I think it's Linus shows Charlie Brown a scar, and he asks Charlie Brown if he has any scars, and Charlie Brown says, oh, I have lots of them, but they're all mental.
Yeah.
And I think in a way that kind of sums up Charlie Brown's view of life, you know, the mental scars.
Yeah.
Did you find any reluctance in newspapers at the time to take on a subject like depression or mental scars, you know?
No, I don't recall anybody ever complaining about that. What editors were afraid of in those days, much more than now, was the mention of personalities in things. There used to be a very wonderful lady who had a program out of Chicago called, she was called Miss Frances, And I used to watch it with my little kids all of the time. And I mentioned her name in a comic strip one day, and some editor complained. He said, we shouldn't be promoting things like that. Well, now people mention almost everything. And, of course, comic strip characters are saying things which they never would have said even 10, 12, 15 years ago. They're actually beginning to swear in comic strips now, which I think is a bad policy.
Well, the closest you've come to swearing in a comic is probably Good Grief.
I have discovered in my life that good grief and rats will cover almost anything that ever happens to you.
How did you start using good grief, which has really become a popular part of the vocabulary?
It was just a natural thing that I always said. If I was playing golf and I missed a 3-foot putt, I might say, oh, good grief, you know. But I've never been one who swore. I've never liked ugly words. I have nothing against, I'm not a purist in that way, but I like words to a certain extent. I'm not well educated so that I'm an expert on them, but I've never cared for any type of ugly language, even words that are not considered swearing words.
Do you think of the characters in Peanuts as each representing a different side of your own character?
I think there's no doubt about it. I doubt that it would be possible to do something every day with a group of characters such as I have without each one of those characters being a little bit of myself or being a little bit of the creator. I think this is the only way you can do it. This is why I suppose the characters do change little by little. I try to be consistent in their personalities, but I also think that none of us is ever really consistent in the things that we do and say. We all have our little good points and bad points, and this is what the characters have. I kind of like the theory that my son Monty has. He called me one day and he says, I've been thinking about your characters, you know, and I've come to the conclusion that Charlie Brown is really the smartest one of the whole group. And I had never even thought much about it, but I have a feeling that he's right.
What part of yourself is Charlie Brown about?
Not as much as people like to think. It just makes a good story, of course. I have not been the loser that Charlie Brown has, although I can remember certainly losses in both baseball and golf and hockey that go back 50 years, and I'm still suffering from them. I think Charlie Brown and I are alike in that we are both fanatics about certain things. I was the same sort of little kid that Charlie Brown was. I looked forward to the baseball games that we were going to have, and if it was raining, I would have been the kind that would have stood out in the rain and saying, where's everybody going? You know, let's play the game. Come on, let's go. You know, I was just dedicated to things like that, and I suppose it's the dedication to drawing that has kept me going these 40 years, because I am completely dedicated to what I do.
Do you get depressed like Charlie Brown?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I've been depressed the last few days.
About
I never quite know why.
About what, do you know?
For one thing, we are in the midst of doing a wonderful ice show here at my ice arena, and there's something about seeing all the beautiful, bright young people out there performing, and I listen to the music. The music brings back memories to me, and I suppose I'm just sensitive to that kind of thing. I don't think I'm any more sensitive than anyone else is, but they do affect me. And little things like that do tend to make me feel depressed. Although Rita Grimsley Johnson wrote a book about me a couple of years ago called Good Grief, and she mentions in there my depression. And I think the use of the word depression is almost wrong. I don't know what word would be more suitable, but I don't think that I am what you would call a really depressed person by any means.
Well, you know, when a child is depressed, like or anxious, like Charlie Brown often is, I think that adults sometimes don't understand it and think, you know, that childhood should be a time when kids are more carefree.
Oh yeah.
I was wondering if you were exposed to a lot of that when you were young, of adults maybe not understanding your moods, and your interior self.
I don't know about the moods, but I think the word anxiety is much more appropriate than depression.
Yeah.
I think I am a very anxious person. Now, my childhood was a good childhood, but there were episodes in our neighborhood where there were some cruel children, a couple of boys, and there's one of them. If I ever see him again sometime, I'm going to kill him. they caused me much unhappiness, and I think this is something that adults tend to forget. It's very difficult out there in the playground to survive. It's a struggle out there. And as we grow older, we drift away from that and we learn how to protect ourselves. But children are defenseless. And if they are forced to be out on that playground and they are too small or they're inadequate in some ways and they just can't defend themselves, it can be a very miserable life.
Now let's get to Lucy. Lucy has a Lucy has a psychiatry booth.
Yeah.
Were you ever in therapy or do you have any faith in therapy?
I don't know enough about it to say I have faith or not. I went through a few sessions over this anxiety business, but the psychiatric booth is really a takeoff, a parody of the old lemonade stands that used to be in comic strips.
Oh, yeah, well, sure.
Yeah. When I was growing up, every comic strip character at some time or another ran a little lemonade stand. And so I was thinking about that one day, and I thought, well, nowadays it'd be much more practical to have a psychiatric booth, and that's how that all started.
How did you come up with Linus's security blanket?
I would say out of the five children that we had, three of them had blankets. And two of them carried the blankets around until they literally crumbled and disappeared. Little by little, chunks would fall off each day until finally there was nothing left. And that was the end of the blanket. And that's what gave me the idea for it. I was always glad that I was the first one who noticed it and used it, because I know if I had not, that Mort Walker, who was very bright, would have latched onto the same idea.
Now, your father and Charlie Brown's father were both barbers. Now, Charlie Brown has no hair. He has that one little lock that comes out.
I don't think of it as not having hair. I think of it as being hair that is so blonde that it just doesn't, it's not seen very clearly, that's all.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if your father always gave you too close of a shave when he cut your hair.
No, but he always gave me haircuts, and when I went to school, I was always looking very nice. My hair was neatly combed, but the embarrassing thing about that was when I used to go into the shop, and he'd be working on me, and maybe he'd be halfway through my haircut, and a real good customer would come in, and he would say, why don't you just sit over there and wait for a little bit, because I have to wait on this man. It was so embarrassing to sit on the bench with just a half a haircut.
Oh, yeah. Charles Schulz is my guest, the creator of Peanuts. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Charles Schulz is my guest, creator of the comic book Peanuts. What did you draw before you started doing Peanuts?
I tried several other comic strips. I always wanted to do something about the Foreign Legion for some reason, which is why Snoopy now leads his legionnaires across the desert. And I had another character about a little girl who was kind of a tomboy. I tried to sell her at different times, but it didn't go over. But I discovered little by little by the few cartoons that I sold to the Saturday Evening Post that when I drew little kids, these seemed to be the type of cartoons that editors liked the best.
What was the first strip that you did with a Charlie Brown or Charlie Brown kind of character in it? Did it start off as the strip that we know now, or was there a more, was there an earlier version of it?
No, but the original submission to United Features was a panel rather than a strip, so there were no definite characters. And then when I went to New York to sign the contract, I took along a batch of about a half a dozen strips I had been working on just to show them what else I could do, and they said immediately that they would much rather have a strip than a panel, because a strip just is easier to sell, it's easier to market. So then they said, well, you'll have to create some definite characters. So I said, well, that's no problem, because I already knew I liked to draw a little dog. And I just went home and I asked my friend Charlie Brown if I could use his name. And he said that was fine. And so I created Patty and Shermie, and those were the four lead characters. The first strip that ever appeared, I wish I had never drawn. It shows Shermie and Patty sitting on a curb, and they see Charlie Brown coming from a distance. And Shermie says, "Here comes Charlie Brown. Yes, sir, good old Charlie Brown." And as he walks by, he says, "How I hate him." See, that shows what I was doing those days, which I would never do now.
Well, why are you sorry that you drew that, though?
Well, I don't think he should have said something like, "How I hate him." It's a little too strong. Nowadays, I think I would make it more mild.
Now, I know that when you first submitted your comic to the syndicate, that they changed the name. They just came up with the name of Peanuts, and you didn't like the name.
Probably the worst title ever thought of for a comic strip, and I always make sure that when I am interviewed that I say this, because I like to get revenge. But it is totally inappropriate. It has nothing to do with what I am drawing. But I don't think the people at the syndicate, even though they were wonderful gentlemen, and I owe them a good deal because we've become close friends, but I don't think they had any comprehension of what I was going to do. I think the difficulty of being a syndicate editor is that you have to realize the potential of this young person who is sitting across from you when you are looking at his or her work. Is this person a fanatic, or is he or she just somebody who's doing something for a lark? And they should have recognized immediately that here they had somebody who was a fanatic and somebody who was really dedicated. They should have listened to me a little more carefully. Fortunately, titles of comic strips are not that important. Who knows that Popeye is really called Thimble Theater? It's really not important.
What's wrong with Peanuts?
Peanuts, in the first place, is insignificant. It indicates something that is not very important. And also, it is not the name of the lead character, which is what I said would deceive people when the strip first began, and it certainly proved to be true. I just hate it when somebody says, "Oh, I liked what Peanuts and his dog did the other day." That drives me crazy.
No, so what title did you want to give it?
I think I would have liked to have called it Good Old Charlie Brown. But as the years have gone on, I realized that Snoopy would simply have been the best name because he has turned out to be the lead character. But we didn't know that, of course, at the time.
Now, have you ever hired artists to draw for you like most people who do newspaper strips end up doing?
I would quit before I'd do that. The only way I suppose that it could happen would be if I had a temporary illness and I simply couldn't keep up the schedule. But even then, I think we would just drop the strip until I became well again. Before I had heart surgery, I worked very hard, and I got 3 months ahead on the strip because I didn't know how much time I would lose. As it turned out, I only lost a month. But I hope that no one else ever touches the strip, because the strip is me. And this doesn't mean that I'm critical of others who do have assistance. Some of them certainly need them, but I would never want anybody else to do it. And my children feel the same way, and they insisted in putting in our syndicate contract that when I retire or die, the strip goes too, because they said, and I quote, "We don't want anybody else drawing Dad's strip."
Do you have any plans to retire?
All my friends are retiring, and it annoys me to talk to people who are even younger than myself, and I say, "What are you doing these days?" "Oh, I'm retired." "What are you doing?" Well, what really annoys me, Terry, is when they say, "Oh, are you still drawing the strip?" I feel that they should recognize that someone else has not been doing the strip, that it is such a personal strip, such a personal form of creativity, and it really is insulting that they think we could just go out and find somebody else to do it. Now, maybe it could happen, but I like to think, I'm egotistical enough to think that they just can't find somebody else to do it.
Well, I mean, there'd be the very unfortunate option of stopping the strip if you really wanted to retire.
Oh, sure, I can stop at any time.
But obviously you don't want to. I mean, obviously working is an important part of your life.
I don't know how to do anything else, and I don't want to play golf every day. So I suppose what I would like to stop is all of the nuisance things that happen, all of the continual stream of requests that come into the studio for drawings and special appearances and things like that. I've got to try to learn to cut all of that out, and I'm doing the best that I can. In fact, just the other night I said to my wife, "Jeannie, look, I said no 3 times tonight." that was pretty good, I thought.
It's hard for you to say no?
Very hard. And I despise autographing. I hate to say it, but I really despise autographing. But it's bad enough, all the trouble, but then it's the guilt that is laid upon you because you've turned somebody down for autographs. But I just can't stand it anymore.
What's bad about autographing? Is it coming up with something to say or just the whole absurdity of it?
Well, yeah, and my hands shake, and sometimes it's a nuisance. And who wants an autograph a gum wrapper? I had a fella ask me for an autograph over in the parking lot the other day at the mall, and his car was still moving. And he drove by me, and he says, "Hey, aren't you Charles Schultz?" I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Could I have your autograph?" His car was still moving. I says, "This is ridiculous." And I kept right on walking.
You said your handshakes. Is it embarrassing for you to autograph if your handshakes?
Yeah, very embarrassing. Sometimes I'd like to draw them a little Snoopy, but my hand shakes, and that is embarrassing.
Does that get in the way of cartooning at home?
Yeah, I have to. It's not any worse than it used to be, but I kind of prop one hand against the other, and I can't draw as fast as I used to. I used to be quite facile with the pen. I used to be quite proud of the pen line that I had, but I have to be more careful now. But I just draw a little more slowly, that's all. And I letter very slowly, but I still letter very well and very clearly, I think.
Have you ever wanted to do a strip besides Peanuts?
Yes, I never will. I've often thought that I would have liked to have drawn a strip about real children, with the cartooning not being as exaggerated as it is with mine, with the larger heads and the little tiny bodies. I think there is something there. However, we are now caught in this terrible bind where we have such small space in which to work that it would be almost impossible to do something like that.
Is it loyalty to Peanuts also that would hold you back from doing a different strip?
Yeah, because I like what I have, and I think that every thought that comes to me can be used in the Peanuts strip in some way or another. I never think of something and say, well, gee, I wish I could use that, but it just won't work in my strip. I have a repertory group here that will accommodate anything that I can think of, whether it's something fairly serious, you know, like certain scriptural references, something from the Old Testament, way on down to something really corny, and then I'll give it to Snoopy, and he'll tell Woodstock something which is just absurd and corny, and they both laugh so hard they fall off the doghouse and land on their heads. you know, those things are really fun, and that's what cartooning is all about. I think that cartoonists have to be very much aware of their medium, because you cannot compete with live actors, television actors, movie actors, radio actors on their own ground. You have to remember that you can do things that they can't do. Cartoon characters can flip over and do things that live actors can't do, but they can do things that we can't do. So you always must be aware of your own medium.
Charles Schultz, it's been such a great pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your time with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry. I appreciate it.
Charles Schultz is the creator of the Peanuts comic strip. Our interview was recorded 1 year ago. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1963, she was 16, her hair was in a flip, and her first record rose to number one on the charts. Coming up, we talk with Leslie Gore about her hits from the 60s, like It's My Party, Judy's Turn to Cry, and You Don't Own Me. And we find out what she's been up to since then. In 1983, Barbara Streisand directed and starred in the movie Yentl. Now she's taking on that dual role again with her new movie Prince of Tides. Film critic Stephen Schiff tells us how Streisand does this time in front of and behind the camera. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Mikhail Gorbachev has resigned as president of the Soviet Union. In a 14-minute speech on national television, Gorbachev ended nearly 7 years in power. NPR's Mike Schuster is in Moscow.
He went on the air at 7 p.m. Moscow time and wasted not a second in cutting to the heart of the matter. He said he was discontinuing his office as president of the USSR. On a matter of principle, he said, although he believes in the sovereignty and independence of states, that he couldn't support separation, as what he called the Commonwealth of Independent Nations, which has emerged here. And so he said, because of this principled stand, he had decided to leave his office of president.
In his speech, Gorbachev defended his record as Soviet leader, saying his radical economic and political reforms were necessary. He gave a reluctant endorsement to the Commonwealth of Independent States, saying he had concern but also confidence in the new leadership. President Bush will address the nation this evening on the demise of the Soviet Union. Mr. Bush returned from his holiday retreat at Camp David to make the speech from the White House. It will begin at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Leaders of the Six-Nation Gulf Cooperation Council have ended their three-day summit in Kuwait, their first since the end of the Gulf War. Lori Neff reports that while the aim of the conference was to beef up regional security, the council took no substantive steps in that direction.
In their final communique, the leaders of the six Gulf Arab states accused Iraq of not complying with UN resolutions resulting from its invasion of Kuwait. They ruled out any dealings with Baghdad until it stopped what they call delaying tactics. However, even though the aim of the summit was to discuss how best to defend the Gulf region, the GCC failed to agree on any concrete plans to prevent any future aggression in the area. One proposal to set up a 100,000-man Gulf army was said to be unworkable due to lack of funds, manpower, and problems in resolving command structure. The council did approve a $10 billion fund to aid Arab nations hurt by the Gulf War. However, the communique made no mention of how the fund would be financed, and who would get the money. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff reporting.
Iran today strongly protested to Switzerland about the arrest of one of its embassy employees in Bern this week. The worker is wanted in connection with the murder of former Iranian Prime Minister Shapur Bakhtiar. The Swiss Charge d'Affaires in Tehran was summoned to the foreign ministry, where he was told that Iran is gravely concerned about the arrest. Bakhtiar and his assistant were found stabbed to death and their throats slit in the former premier's Paris apartment last August. Bakhtiar, the premier, served under the last Shah of Iran. There have been at least six other arrests in the incident. There's speculation as well that the assassination was ordered by Iranian authorities. The stock market is closed today in observance of Christmas Day. This is NPR. Convicted bond swindler Charles Keating Jr. was released yesterday on $300,000 bond, but he left his son, Charles Keating III, in the federal jail cell that father and son had shared. Both Keatings and two other co-defendants face 77 federal counts of fraud and racketeering. The senior Keating had already been convicted on California fraud charges. He will be sentenced in February. Keating insists that he is innocent and called the charges an indescribable onslaught of government against him. Residents in parts of Texas are spending their Christmas Day assessing flood damage. Several days of torrential rains have claimed at least 15 lives and left two people missing. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF in Houston reports.
Texas Governor Ann Richards has asked President Bush to approve federal disaster aid for Bastrop, Bosque, Brown, Dallas, and Travis counties, where overflowing creeks and rivers left cities under several feet of water last week. Most residents in North, Central, and West Texas have been able to return home in time to sift through the damage on Christmas Day. Meanwhile, hundreds of residents in Southeast Texas are heading out today. Some have spent the holiday in Red Cross shelters. Others plan to move to higher ground tomorrow. The Trinity, Colorado, Brazos, and Guadalupe rivers continue to swell as floodwaters from North Texas make it downstream. Officials say as long as it doesn't rain for the next few days, flooding may not be as severe as expected, although forecasters are predicting showers tonight. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
The Afghan government reported at least 8 people have been killed and several injured as Afghan rebels fired about 10 rockets into Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. One rocket reportedly hit a children's playground, killing 4 children. 9 others landed elsewhere in the city. There's been no independent confirmation of the death toll. Official Afghan radio has blamed the attack on the Mujahideen. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. You know who's doing a cabaret act? Leslie Gore. Everyone who listened to Top 40 radio in the mid-60s knew her hits. It's My Party, Judy's Turn to Cry, She's a Fool, You Don't Own Me, That's the Way Boys Are, and Maybe I Know. You know who used to produce her? Quincy Jones. In Gore's cabaret act, she sings Porter and Gershwin, as well as the songs that made her famous. She's still singing this one, my favorite. It's a song she chose herself.
At the time, I know I chose it because I liked the strength in the lyric. But for me, it was not a song about being a woman. It was a song about being a person and what was involved with that. Of course, it got picked up as an anthem for women, which makes me very proud. And today, when I sing that song, You Don't Own Me takes on a whole other set of meanings for me now.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have come to see it as a proto-feminist anthem.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't think of it that way when you were recording it?
I didn't. What I was impressed with was the strength. I've always hated wimpy woman. I've never understood it. So when I first heard this piece of material, I knew it was one I wanted to do.
Now, how did you choose it? How was it offered to you?
This is a great story. I was actually practically kidnapped in a hotel up in the Catskills, Grossinger's, when it was still in existence. I had gone up there to do some promotion for WAEB, and Gene Kay, who was a major disc jockey in the Allentown area, and I was sitting at the pool, and 2 young men from Philadelphia, John Madera and Dave White, literally took me into one of the cabanas and played me You Don't Own Me on just a guitar and sang it for me. I fell in love with it immediately, and I made an appointment for them to come into New York on Monday and sing it for Quincy Jones, who also loved it.
So they let you choose your own songs. I mean, I don't know if everybody had that opportunity.
Well, with Quincy and I, as a matter of fact, Quincy was into the show at the Rainbow and Stars a couple of Friday evenings ago, and we had a wonderful reunion, and one of the things we talked about was a couple of the songs that he made me record that I never wanted to record. And what we would do at that time is he would find something or say he didn't want me to record something, and we would negotiate it out. I would do the song I didn't want to do for him, and he would do the song ostensibly he didn't want to do but for me.
So which songs did he make you do?
Oh, there was a song called Sometimes I Wish I Were a Boy. I really hated that one. And there was another one called I Struck a Match. Oh, it was hateful. And as a matter of fact, we had a terrific joke about it. He got this fantastic velvet box from Cartier and presented it to me the day that the album was released with I Struck a Match on it. And I opened it up, and it was a huge wooden match.
Need I point out, these songs were not hits.
Need you point out, indeed. Of course not. I knew my stuff.
Now, what's the story behind how you made your first record?
Well, it's an unusual story, but not in showbiz terms. I was studying with a vocal coach in the New York area, a man by the name of Myron Earnhardt, and one day I went in to do my lesson, and he said to me that he had booked a tiny recording studio just upstairs from him. We took the piano player and went upstairs and did, I think, 4 piano voice demos, pretty much 1, 2, 3, 4, right in a row. And when I left there that day, I literally had 2 what looked like 78-size records and 2 songs, one on each side. And we pressed up a couple of these, and as it happened, a man by the name of Joe Glazer, who was the president of ABC Booking, which was a booking agency, met Irving Green, who was president of Mercury Records, and played him my demos. Irving was impressed with the fact that I was 16 and had an interesting feel for music, and he needed a project for Quincy Jones, so he put us together.
Was this the Joe Glazer who was Armstrong's agent, too?
That's exactly the man, yes. He was quite an individual, quite a man.
So It's My Party was the very first side you recorded?
That's right. Quincy brought maybe 200 demo records to my house several Saturdays before we had gone into the studio. And because I had never sat and picked this kind of material before, the first record he put on for me was a song called It's My Party, and it was demoed by, I don't actually know who actually sang the song. And it was a very spirited little tune, and I liked it because there was something kind of rebellious in its attitude. And when it was over, Quincy said, well, what do you think of that little bit? So I said, well, I like it, but I don't know if it's, let's put it in the maybe pile. And after we went through 200 demos, we had one maybe, and it was It's My Party.
So what do you remember of that first recording session when you made It's My Party?
Well, the first thing I remember, which is so different from today, is we recorded 4-track. And I think most people know today that, gosh, we use 24, 32. Some people actually marry 2 machines and have 64 tracks. So the state of the art has greatly improved. This meant that we had 2 microphones basically hanging in the studio, strategically placed over the band. We had a 3rd microphone in the center of all of the background singers, and there were about 8 of them, and then I was in a little booth, and that was the 4th mic. So that was pretty much the setup. When we counted off, you heard everything that was going to be there. Today we layer a lot, and we track a lot. Then you just went in and did it. When you walked out of the studio, you were pretty well mixed and knew exactly what everything sounded like.
Ms. Magazine, there was recently a piece with you and K.D. Lang having a conversation with each other.
Yes.
And you said that when you were a kid, you'd sing in front of the mirror, and you'd slick back your hair like Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
But when you finally walked out on stage in the spring of 1963, you went dressed like a nice little girl and performed as you were expected to.
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare what you wanted to look like when you started to performing with how you ended up looking?
Well, you know, I still basically have a very, I'm very sound-oriented. Image, which has become a major part of our business, is not what I would call my primary interest. So what it was really was sort of this, and you can probably relate, let's say you had a party to go to, and I might compare it to having the Ed Sullivan show to do. I would say to my mother or my cousin, what do you think I should wear? And we would, you know, then go shopping for something we thought was appropriate. Because the only influence on my life at that time was my mother, I very often walked out looking sort of like my mini mother. you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I didn't have anyone saying to me, just put on a pair of jeans and a white shirt, which probably would have felt comfortable to me at the time, but I probably would have had a problem with it. Because I did believe you get up on stage and you dress up because there are lots of people there and it's important and you want to show yourself off to your best advantage. I'm a little bit more savvy now in terms of image, but at 16, you don't necessarily have a clear-cut image of yourself.
Well, if you're going shopping with your mother for performances, you're not going to end up looking like the Ronettes.
Exactly.
Singer Leslie Gore is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together. Brighter than a lucky penny. When you're near, the rain goes, disappears, dear, and I feel so fine just to know that you are mine. My life is sunshine.
Leslie Gore is my guest. So what did you do when you stopped having hits?
Well, I did continue through college, and I graduated, and I'd say the hits kind of stopped in 67. I graduated college in 68. So what I did was, I'm feeling kind of like a musician without a place to play, I began doing other things, like summer stock, and getting into other areas of my craft, not just singing, and not just singing on a stage, but singing as a character, and getting a bit more into acting. And I think that formative period in my life has probably stood me in the greatest stead, because today I get up on a stage and I do sing, but for me, singing is actually secondary. The singing is what I do and how I communicate it. But I'm not thinking about singing. I'm thinking about the situation in the song. And what happens is an intense identification with lyric, which comes out as acting.
Mm-hmm. Let me play something that's from the 60s. From an album called My Town, My Guy and Me. And this is a standard. This is a Julie Stein, Sammy Kahn song called The Things We Did Last Summer. Was it your idea to do a standard on this? I want to show a different side of your singing.
Probably. The very first album that Quincy and I did together, we had to base it on It's My Party, but we had to throw it together quite quickly, and it was called I'll Cry If I Want To, and it was all cry songs. It was Cry Me a River. It was the Johnny Ray's cry. So we had established a premise early on whereby I would do standards, maybe with just a slight rock and roll edge. But by and large, I don't think of The Things We Did Last Summer as a rock piece. We did it, I think, just because I loved the song. I believe Don Costa did the arrangement, and a superlative one.
Okay, let's hear it. I think we'll hear a different side of your singing.
Sure.
The boat rides we would take, the moonlight on the lake, the way we danced and hummed our favorite song. The things we did last summer, I'll remember all winter long.
Since the early 70s, have you been singing a lot on the oldie circuit? I guess there really wasn't an oldie circuit in the early 70s.
There wasn't, actually. The oldies really began coming back strong, I'd say, right after 1980. About 1980, 81, it really started to pick up. And I did, in fact, take advantage of it. And it certainly, actually, during the 70s, no one wanted to hear Leslie Gore. I was writing my own material and working small clubs, tiny clubs, and doing mostly original material. So this whole nostalgia kick at least helped me out financially at a time that it was fairly grim for me.
Leslie Gore, do you know what's become of Susan Michaels, who was the president of the Leslie Gore fan club?
Yes, I do. Susan Michaels was an amalgam of my middle name, which is Sue, and my brother's first name, which is Michael. And it was actually my grandma, my Nana, who is no longer with us, who became Susan Michaels and would try to answer all the fan mail personally and handwritten. And that's who Susan Michaels was.
Oh, that's great. So when did the fan club officially break up?
Well, I'm trying to think, there is yet an official Leslie Gore fan club. About 15 years ago, a gentleman by the name of Jack Natoli, who lives in Paterson, New Jersey, asked if he could be the president, and we turned everything over to him, and he does an incredible job.
Well, Leslie Gore, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Leslie Gore's greatest hits are reissued on compact disc.
This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of NPR's All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, a report from Moscow and NPR's Mike Schuster on the resignation of Mikhail Gorbachev as president of the Soviet Union. And today, somewhat ahead of schedule, the red flag of the Soviet Union came down from atop the Kremlin, and the tricolor of Russia went up in its place. Also, a special Christmas present for you today. Storyteller Bill Harley has a tale of youth and Christmas and saving up to buy Christmas presents for his family for the first time. And also a report from Chicago on the businesses there that have to stay open on Christmas Day. Those stories today coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
After keeping herself out of the limelight for years, Barbara Streisand is back with a vengeance. She has a CD box set, and her long-awaited new movie, the first she's directed since Yentl in 1983, is out for Christmas. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of The Prince of Tides.
This is a movie for people who want more movies like The Way We Were. Big, fluffy romances that wear a halo of ersatz significance. Except, The Way We Were was fun in its vulgar way. And The Prince of Tides is a solemn, reverential, middle-brow bore. The Pat Conroy novel it's based on was at least an absorbing, trashy read, and you could get engrossed enough to forget about its tremulous, overwritten attempts to wade into the big muddy where Faulkner and Styron once splashed. But right from the opening voiceover, with Nick Nolte struggling to sound southern amid keening strings, The Prince of Tides feels phony and strained. Nolte plays Tom Wingo, an out-of-work schoolteacher who lives with his wife and daughters on the South Carolina coast where he was raised. His sister has just attempted suicide in New York, and her psychiatrist there, played by Barbara Streisand, wants Tom to head north and discuss the patient with her to help with the treatment. But Tom is a strangely closed, evasive man. He doesn't want to explore the past, doesn't want to touch on the family secrets. His sessions with the psychiatrist, Dr. Lowenstein, begin to feel more and more as though he himself were in psychoanalysis and in love. He starts falling hard for Lowenstein, as you can hear from this scene in a restaurant in which he's just confessed to having dreams about her.
You want to hear?
I'm not sure.
Well, don't worry, this one's G-rated.
This one?
Uh-huh.
Tell me.
There was a blinding snowstorm right here in New York City. I went out for a walk and I ran into you. We decided to go to the Rainbow Room. No one was there. So we started a slow dance. What do you think it means?
You said it was a snowstorm. Blinding snowstorm. Maybe there's something you're afraid to see.
If you think this is the kind of movie that will later feature our love-struck couple dancing alone in the Rainbow Room, I'm terribly afraid you're right. It's also the kind of movie in which every scene labors towards some explosive conflict, whether it's merited or not. Nick Nolte shows an emotional range he's never quite exhibited before, but the trouble is he has to show all of it in practically every scene. He goes from Raging Bull to Cutie Pie Charmer every 10 minutes or so. Streisand, meanwhile, works against all her instincts, toiling to seem brainy and professional. Her nails are hilariously long, and she has at least 2 hairdos a day. The camera keeps backlighting her to show off her ruby-toned tresses. And yes, friends, you want leg shots, you got leg shots. But every time we see her face, it's busily composing itself into an attempt at stern authority that's so laughable you want to send her diplomas to the police lab for analysis. It's such a relief to see good old Brooklyn Barbara in the few scenes that have her cracking wise and grinning. It's a relief, but it has nothing, unfortunately, to do with her character. Still, the worst thing about the movie is its central premise, which takes dime store Freudianism to the limit. Yes, this is one of those movies in which our main character has problems, and the problems all stem from one awful secret thing that happened deep in the past. And so what the patient has to do is confess the secret and have a good cry, and then, of course, he's cured. If only life and psychiatry were that simple. If only this movie weren't.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Have a good holiday. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, rock critic Ken Tucker picks the best records of the year, and David Bianculli reviews the year in television. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.